This is Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, joining Dr. Craig in the studio. We've been talking a lot, Bill, about why is there something rather than nothing? And that might be the rock bottom of all philosophical questions. I'm sure that that's been asked many times before. Leibniz, in fact, this article that we're looking at says that the argument itself dates back to Plato. But before we get into this article, some argue that it's impossible for there to be nothing, just nothing, that there just has to be something.
Right. That's the theist's position, Kevin. Yeah. We believe that God is a metaphysically necessary being, and therefore it's impossible for there to be nothing.
Yeah.
So that's actually correct.
Well,
there must be a necessary being.
They do this to try to undercut the question itself, and that is, since it's impossible for there to be just nothing at all, then why ask it?
Well, you know? Because that implies there must be a metaphysically necessary being. So if they agree with that, you see, they already have agreed with 90% of the argument. The person who says it's impossible for there to be nothing agrees then, I think, that there's a metaphysically necessary being. And then the question is, well, what is it? Is it the universe? Is it matter and energy? Is it something in the universe? Or is it a transcendent reality beyond the universe?
James R. Henderson, who is professor of mathematics and philosophy, wrote this article for the Internet Infidels. And he says that you run into this question as if it's a conversation ender. That it ends the conversation when this comes up. The YouTube type seven questions all non-believers must answer postings and things like that. But he says that even more sophisticated philosophers like Janis Soskus, professor of philosophical theology at Cambridge, says this: I was once invited to take part in a radio program about miracles and was asked whether I believed in them. Yes, of course, I said. And the researcher replied that she had recruited a leading humanist to put the contrary case. What would you say to him? I answered, why is there something rather than nothing? That's still a big problem. And believe me, cosmology hasn't answered it. Astrophysicists hasn't answered it. It isn't any more logical to say, with Aristotle, that the universe has simply always existed than to say that there's a creator. Bertrand Russell's reply to the Jesuit philosopher Frederick Copplestone, that there's no answer to this question, doesn't seem terribly satisfactory either. Now, I think you would agree with the article and the writer here that asking that question is not a proof of God.
Absolutely. I agree with that. I don't think it is a proof of God. It's not a conversation stopper. As he said, it's the beginning of a conversation, and I think Henderson's quite right about that. But I would say that he just mischaracterizes what Janet Soskus has said here. I know her, and I had no idea that she was so sympathetic to natural theology. I'm really proud of Janet for saying what she said. Now, this fellow in response to her says that she is not offering an argument, but just a conversation stopper. Now, why does he say that? Well, he gives two reasons. He says, nowhere in the article is there any explicit or implicit mention of the cosmological argument. No mention of a first cause, an unmoved mover, or even any oblique reference to the elements of the cosmological argument. Well, I think that's simply not true. The debate between Russell and Copplestone that she references on the BBC was a debate about the cosmological argument. And she notes the inadequacy of Russell's reply to Copplestone. Similarly, Aristotle's argument was for a prime mover, an unmoved mover. And she says that simply saying the universe has always existed doesn't explain why there's something rather than nothing. And of course, Leibniz's question was in the context of a cosmological argument. So it's in the background here all the way through. Now, secondly, he says any leading humanist could instantly counter the cosmological argument by citing any number of well-known objections. So she couldn't possibly be offering this argument because it's so full of holes that any leading humanist would see that. Well, I would beg to differ. I think that what she's offered is clearly an argument. Notice how she identifies the question, why is there something rather than nothing? She says that's still a big problem. And that's exactly what this Henderson characterizes it as later in his article as well. It's a problem to be solved. And then she deals with attempts to answer this problem and dismisses them. She says astrophysics hasn't answered why there's something rather than nothing. She says it's inadequate to say with Aristotle the universe has simply always existed. And she says Russell's response to Copleston, namely just saying, well, there's no answer, doesn't seem satisfactory. So it seems to me she's clearly engaged in an argument here. She's posing a question, and then she's trying to block off certain ways of answering that question, leaving theism as the best answer. So I was very pleased to see Janet Soskis's defense of the Leibnizian cosmological argument here, and I think Henderson has just missed the point completely.
Well, he has if he doesn't see that she sees this as a conversation starter rather than a conversation stopper. And while I was reading this article, Bill, I was trying to think, well, wait a minute, have I ever heard anyone use just that phrase from Leibniz as a conversation stopper at the end all? And you know what? Yes, I have. In fact, someone who's quite well known, he said, I'll ask the atheist one thing. Why is there something rather than nothing? There it is, right there. Well, I think, wow, he must be treating it as a kind of a conversation stopper as well. But I happen to know him and know that he can also give reasons for why anything outside of theism, of God, is inadequate in this. So maybe Henderson here has just run into this as some kind of an apologetic in and of itself, and he's trying to point out that, you know.
There certainly are lazy Christian apologists who aren't interested in really exploring the problems deeply, but just having gotcha objections or questions, and someone might well have misused this in this way. But if you'll look at, for example, my chapter in On Guard on Leibniz's argument, you can see this is just the beginning of the discussion. And then we go on to talk about the principle of sufficient reason, whether or not the universe could be the metaphysically necessary being, reasons to think the universe is contingent, and so forth. And we need to do our homework on that.
He says, in this venue, I will ignore the fact that this non-cosmological why is there something rather than nothing gambit is plainly an argument from ignorance. To this point, theists would do well to heed the words of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We are to find God in what we know, not in what we don't. I will further ignore that it poses a false dilemma. Surely there are more possibilities. Okay, well, yeah, there you go. Again, that's why it's a conversation starter, why we need to do a conceptual analysis of why there is something rather than nothing, what those are. And I like what Dietrich Bonhoeffer says here, Bill, because he kind of dispels the God of the gaps argument by saying, you know, we can argue for God in what we know, not in what we don't know.
Exactly. And so many atheists misconstrue arguments for God's existence as God of the gaps sorts of arguments when they're not that at all. Leibniz's argument, being purely metaphysical, has absolutely nothing to do with empirical or scientific evidence or gaps in our knowledge.
Where did Leibniz go after asking that question? Did he go to there can only be two types of being?
What he said was that the sufficient reason, as he put it, for the existence of the universe can neither be found in past states of the universe, even if these regress infinitely, nor in anything in the universe, nor in the universe itself. And therefore, the sufficient reason for the existence of the universe must be found beyond it in a transcendent being.
Henderson, he brings out a problem of, you know, what accounts for the paper printing out of the copier when I push the button? And he says, the presence of little tiny monks in there who are making the copies does, in fact, explain it. But many explanations are possible. However, evidence supporting my monk claim or any proposed hypothesis must be of a novel, non-new copy-making kind, you know, and things like that. And so, again, when I look at this, I see a road to comparing God as a not very plausible kind of a make-believe explanation that, okay, it may serve as an explanation, but it sure ain't very good.
That's a good point, Kevin. The analogy is very prejudicial, isn't it? Although the point of the analogy is quite different. He could have used the internal mechanisms of the Xerox company to explain why the copy comes out of the machine and would still be able to make the same point, namely, you need more evidence than just the copy spitting out to support your explanation of why the copies are being made. But he does choose a very prejudicial explanation, I think, which poisons the well against the God hypothesis. But again, I think we will agree with him when he says the existence of the universe is what is to be explained, and the God hypothesis is invoked to explain it. We must seek other kinds of evidence that goes beyond the simple and uncontroversial existence of the universe. Other hypotheses will be put forward for testing, and these two can be supported only by the evidence of a different sort than the very existence of the universe. And that's exactly what Leibniz did. That's what I do in presenting the cosmological argument. And that's exactly what Janet Soskis did too. Take her point about the eternality of the universe. If the universe began to exist, then it follows logically that it cannot be a metaphysically necessary being, because an essential property of anything that's metaphysically necessary is that it's eternal. It has to exist. Its non-existence is impossible. So if the universe is not eternal in the past, I think that just puts the nails in the coffin of the hypothesis that the universe is the metaphysically necessary being. And that is clearly evidence of a different sort than the very existence of the universe. So it meets exactly the desideratum, or the desired evidence that he would want us to bring forth. So I completely agree with him that the question, why is there something rather than nothing, is not a discussion-killing rhetorical device. Rather, it is the identification of a problem that must be solved. That's exactly what Janet Soskitz said. It is still a big problem, she said, and God is the best solution.
Your lovely wife, Jan, uses the cosmological argument, the Kalam, when she's encountered students and things like that, and it serves as a conversation starter for her. And she goes through 1, 2, 3. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. And number two, the universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. And that's kind of a jumping off point. So how would we proceed with why is there something rather than nothing?
Right.
Because you don't stop there.
That's a different argument. That's a different argument than the Kalam cosmological argument. Here, the question, why is there something rather than nothing, isn't even a premise in the argument. That's just a question. It's a question to motivate inquiry. The argument goes like this. Everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or else in an external cause. Premise two, if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. And the third premise is the universe exists. Now, from those three premises, it follows that the explanation of the existence of the universe is God. So the question is, are those three premises true? And then you're involved in a good discussion with your unbelieving friend.
I think we're helping a lot of people here, a lot of budding apologists as well, who may be doing what Henderson accuses them of doing. I've heard at least one person do it, and that is say, why is there something rather than nothing? Yeah, see there? And then you're gone. Turn on your heel and let them think about it. No. If you were to ask that question of someone, or if you use that as a starter, then that argument would follow as kind of a starting point, in the same way that if you were to use the Kalam as a way to start a dialogue, you would do what Jan did. You know, that was my point there. Not yes. That they're the same argument, but that this is
right.
Only a conversation starter.
A discussion of the Kalam argument by saying something like this. Well, where do you think the universe came from?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not a conversation stopper. That's a conversation starter.
Before Henderson ends this article in a positive way, in which we would agree, he takes one more dig, I think, because he says, The important point is that why is there something rather than nothing is not a discussion-killing rhetorical device, an unanswerable question that carries all the weight of proving God's existence, but rather it is the identification of a problem that must be solved. It's not a conversation stopper, it's a conversation starter, and all the heavy lifting is still in front of anyone taking part in that conversation. Amen. I agree with that. But he does make a little dig here. He says, okay, when we're considering why is there something rather than nothing and we get to God, what sort of evidence would we bring to bear for a God? He says we could, for instance, look at a controlled prayer experiment to find out if there is any therapeutic value in praying for patients in hospitals. That would be to test whether God exists. Well, he says this has been done on several occasions and they all fail. There is no therapeutic value in praying for patients. So that smells like just another dig to me about what kind of things you would offer in evidence of the God hypothesis.
Right,
when
that's
this
sort of
comes
a cheap
out.
Shot. I mean, it's totally irrelevant to the premises of the Leibnizian cosmological argument. I already illustrated what sort of evidence you might appeal to for closing the door, for example, on the hypothesis that the universe is the metaphysically necessary being that exists by a necessity of its own nature.
Sure.
And it wouldn't be things like he said.
I mean, come on, James.
Yeah, that's right. Get with the program, James. Come on. Interact with the arguments. They're out there. They've been offered.